Everybody, welcome back to the Insiders Lounge. Today we have another special guest. Drew, thanks for coming on and feel free to introduce yourself.
Thanks, Chad. Yeah, my name is Drew Becky. I'm head of development for Atletico Ottawa, and I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we'll get into your full story as we go on here. But first, let's get into your first soccer memories. What got you into the game, and what are some of your early memories?
Ooh, it's a good one. So I'm from Saskatchewan, and I think my earliest memories would be I played for a team called Queen City, right? Because Regina is named after the Queen. And just I remember the jerseys being reversible. So you could be red or you could be blue. I don't know why that was our colors, but every game, you know, you just switch and they had reversible jerseys. And I thought, you know, we should probably bring that back for the youth and we'd save money on some of the jersey costs that we see in youth soccer
today.
Just
flip the red and the white.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Just do that, right? That's my earliest memory. That was just flipping the jerseys. I thought that was pretty cool.
And then can we talk through your career? You had a bit of a unique journey growing up. So can we talk through your youth career, your time in Germany, and some of your other experiences you had sort of growing up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I immigrated when I was young to Denver, Colorado, and that's where I really played most of my club career. Well, almost all of it. I was part of a club called Real Colorado. And Real was really the biggest club in the area. I was lucky to be a part of that. And they've done well with developing a lot of players. They have their own facilities. At the time I was growing up, we didn't have our own facilities, but I felt was the best coaches. This is before really the Colorado Rapids had an academy like they do now with MLS Next Pro or MLS Next, all those things. And Real's been probably the most successful youth club in Colorado. When I was 14, 15, I joined Vancouver Whitecaps residency program. This was part of the under 17 Canadian national team. A lot of those players were all residing there, and I was invited to join them there. There's a coach by the name of Thomas Niendorf, who was responsible for bringing Owen Hargreaves from Calgary to Bayern Munich. And he had deep connections in Germany, and he was the head coach of the residency program at the time when the Whitecaps were still in the USL Pro, I believe. This is when Martin Nash was playing, all these guys. And so we had opportunities to play within the PDL system that the US had to keep, to play in competitive formats against older men and kids that are people that were a little bit older than us, right? 20, 25-year-olds playing against 16, 17, 18-year-olds. That was a real challenge for us. We also did a lot of tournaments. There was one tournament we went to in Japan, tournament in Germany, and some of us ended up staying and not being offered contracts in Germany. Some guys trained with or signed with Eintracht Frankfurt. You probably remember Samuel Piet was over there at a time. Adam Straith, these are old names. Randy Edwini Bonzu, Philippe Davies, all guys those guys have played full national team caps. Those are the first kind of generation of guys that stayed there. I had an opportunity with 1860 Munich and with Eintracht Frankfurt, but I decided to, I stayed for a little bit, but I wanted to keep my amateurism. And I think at the time it was like a stipend of 500 to $1,000 a month that was going to my mother. And it was great, right? That's good. It was helping my mother, but it wasn't something that if I got injured, right, I didn't have anything to fall back on. And at that time, I felt homesick. I don't think I felt like I was all in. I didn't feel that the culture was really advantageous to me to succeed. I had some family stuff that had gone on at that time that made me want to go home. So you never look back. It had a great shape on my career. This was right during the 2006 FIFA World Cup in Germany. So everything was huge. Yeah. There was a sign you see Oliver Kahn going over the highway. You've probably seen that before. I remember cutting out the newspapers there, and I saved all those. I thought that was really cool to be, you know, within the same program as Owen Hargreaves. He came and spoke to us. That was our first guy to say, whoa, you know, this guy came all the way up through Bayern Munich, played for Manchester United, went to a World Cup, got to watch him in the World Cup, right? A Canadian, right? As somebody that didn't end up playing for Canada, but played at the highest level, and it was really cool to see. So that's a short snippet. And then I decided to keep my amateurism. I went to the University of Denver. I wanted to stay close to my mother and my sisters. And I stayed there for 3 years. Ended up leaving a bit early to go play for the Columbus Crew. played there for a year. I was supposed to be there for 4 years. Coaching changes and things don't usually in your career happen how you think they are. You think you're going to be there for a long time. And yeah, so that's my youth career there. And yeah, it was an eventful one, but one that shaped me to become a pro.
No, you transitioned perfectly. We speak a lot about the pro versus college route, and I'm constantly asking scouts and agents and coaches kind of throughout that process of what's the best route, and it's really just dependent on the player, like you said there. You had your family issues, you have some of your things, and you go, you know what, I think this is best for me right now, and I think no matter what, you when you make that decision, I think it's key of where are you at the moment, and I think that's how you looked at it, and that's really important. So let's get into your time at Denver. So let's speak on your educational side as well as your playing side, and then how you actually balance the two, I think is a good way to move on there.
Yeah, Denver was a little bit different than what I had gone through in my grade 9 through 12. Is Denver works on a quarter system. So it's a 10 weeks. So there's 4 10-week periods. And that was really new for me. I remember going into my first university class and we had a test the second week. And I was like, oh my gosh, I really got to, you know, get on it. And I, you know, it was good. There's a lot of programs that were helpful for the athletes. I was in study hall. I wouldn't say I'm I think of myself as intelligent. I feel like I am, but I need to work at it, especially yeah. In school. I needed to really work at it. And I learned I just needed to ask questions and I needed to speak to my professors. I needed to get to know my professors. And once I did that, they were willing to help me, right? If you get to know them, have a relationship with them, not they say you're not going to do the work, but you create this rapport and they want to help you. And so for that reason, like I was able to get through it. I was probably a B- student. That's where I was. And within the weighted grading scale, right, a B- was anywhere from an 82 to an 84. So I was happy with that at the University of Denver. It's a good academic school. I wish I probably would have studied something a little bit. I'd studied finance and criminology, but I wish I would have studied something more like engineering, or I wish there was more of a trade school there. You know, you could have gone into plumbing or if I had to do it all again, if I didn't play soccer right, I would go to a trade school. I'm not against university, but you know, at the time, and I know it's more expensive now, it's like it's a $230,000 education. Yeah. Like for what? You know, and as you said there, I think as you made an important point, everybody's journey is different. And if you're good enough, they're gonna find you where you're at. Right? That's key to know. So wherever you're at, you know, hopefully you're going to get an opportunity, but they're going to find you if you're good enough. And so that's to say, you don't need to go to some Ivy League school. It's good to get your education, but balancing the books and soccer were tough at first, for sure, right? You're tired. You don't want to go to study hall. There was a mandated number of hours you had to stay in study hall. And if you ran out of work, you had to find something to do. But I'm not against those things. Those are good things. But finding that balance was definitely a tough go in the first quarter of university.
And then the playing side, how did that go for you? Did you stay all 4 years?
I stayed 3 years. I stayed three and a half years. I left early. Looking back, should I have left early? Yeah, I was fine. I was ready to go. You know, I was offered a contract and it was something that was important to me and I was ready for that. And I love school too, but I was able to finish a couple of years later. I only had a few credits left to do. I was able to finish, but I was prepared at that time. I had my coach, Bobby Muse, who's now the coach at Wake Forest, was a good coach in demanding a lot of the athletes, right? Demanding a lot of my teammates. I wouldn't say a lot of them had the aspirations to go pro, right? They were looking somewhere elsewhere. And for that reason, I think I wanted to get out of there. I wanted to be more around a professional environment. Not to say it wasn't. We had all the great facilities, an amazing grass field, the stadium, amazing weight room. So all the stuff was there to become a pro. I just think some of the decisions that other people made, it wasn't the best environment to be advantageous to becoming one, right? You know, university can be, you know, that's where you live life yeah. there and you learn a lot of things. And I just didn't fit what I was wanting to do. So it was good to be able to leave a bit early and do that.
And then can you talk us through the draft process, how it actually all kind of came together, and then your time at Columbus Crew?
Yeah, so everybody, the super draft, however you want to take it, my view of it, it's a bit silly. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but I understand that's the university path. I think it's a bit different than it was how many years ago now, 12 years ago. Back then, it was the be-all, end-all, and you wanted to get in there. You wanted to get into the super draft, and you wanted to be in certain positions to make, you know, have a better contract, X, Y, Z. We had a combine before the super draft, right? You meet with certain teams, and they have interest in you, and they say, you know, hey, we like you here. We're looking for a right back. We're looking for a center back. We're looking for a midfielder. And they want to get to know the person. So you have meetings with certain teams, and you don't really know exactly what they see in you out of those meetings. But I had a great conversation with I wasn't expected to go to Columbus. I had a meeting with them, but I wasn't expected to go there. I was told by Portland that I was going to get picked at the end of the first round. And the middle of the second round. But Columbus traded up, and I got picked by Columbus. So whoever cares, you know, like it just ended up. You think you're going to one place and you're talking to the coaches. And I remember Caleb Porter was the coach at Columbus, and he was a university coach at the University of Akron. And we'd played against them. And I'd got to know him because with Canada for the Olympic qualifying before the super draft, we'd played against the States and we'd beat the States. And I had a good conversation with him to say, hey, you know, this would be a good opportunity in Portland, blah, blah, blah. So I was excited. I wanted to go there. I wanted to play for somebody that kind of fit my style of play. Ended up going to the total opposite in Columbus. And we had a Polish coach that didn't really talk to any of the players. He was fine. You know, that's just how it is. Didn't have anybody on the staff to really give you direction as to being a young pro. I had an inclination of what I needed to do, right? I needed to bide my time. Back then, they had the reserve league, so I was getting plenty of games. I also had an injury that year, just that I was getting used to the grass. It was so soft, right? And we were used to playing on hard fields and playing in all different kinds of environments. So that didn't help either. And then the coach got fired with about 10 games left to go, and Greg Berhalter came in. I got to go to preseason the next year. And Berhalter's quite he's a hard coach, right? He demands a lot. And I don't think that I fit his system. So I was released at the end of preseason. And it was the best thing for me. It was the best thing for me. I was able to leave and get a bunch of games at a young age. And when you can get games at a young age and show that you can play, then you're going to have a long career.
And we mentioned how you sort of looked up to some of those Canadian, whether they were on the national team or just Canadian players. And you also had your time with the Canadian national team at a few different youth levels as well. Can you talk about sort of your different times with, I know you mentioned like the Olympic qualifiers, some of those times with the actual national team, and how that compared to some of your club, your pro level teams as well, like kind of the difference between the two?
Yeah, I was quite lucky and blessed to be part from when I was 16 all the way up to just the Olympic team, right? I had an opportunity to go in that year with Columbus to the national team, but I was injured. So I never got another opportunity, and that's totally fine. Things happen for certain reasons. And being involved at that at a young age, there's that level of professionalism that demands that you adhere to certain things, right? Showing up on time, not being late to, you know, meals, that includes that, you know, having one-on-one video sessions, having all your training sessions filmed and critiqued. Playing against high level competition, the best that, you know, are at your age. I remember we went to a tournament in Guadalajara, and we played against Mexico. We played against Japan, some Brazilian teams and Mexican teams, and we got killed, right? But it opened our eyes to, okay, what do we need to do to become better and be at the better, you know, the best level? Canada, I'd say individually, we had very good players, but for whatever reason, and I think this is partly of the national team too, we could never put it together. We could never put together. I think individually we were quite good, but we never had enough time together, or whatever the excuse was. So if you're comparing to what the youth game is into whatever you need to be a pro, there's so many little details that you take away from high-level competition or being involved in an environment that demands you be to be your best. And that helps you going to university too, being in a rigorous program that demands that you do things every day, you have a good routine. I think that's missed a lot on the process of being pro. They see, you know, Vinicius playing, they see Mbappe, but they don't see the work that goes in before he steps on the field to score two goals, right? There's a tremendous, tremendous amount of work done off the field, and you know that. But I think there's that fallacy a bit with Instagram and Twitter, right? You get to see it every day. It's right in front of you. Oh, I can achieve that, you know. But hey, take a second here and realize how much work it is and sacrifice. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the sacrifice part is key. I think people don't realize there's a lot of, and that's years and years. It's not just his day-to-day now. It's what he was doing when he was 10, when he was 11, and growing up. Exactly. I think that's the real importance. Let's get to the present day. You're working with Atletico Ottawa. Can we get into your role, what your day-to-day looks like at the moment?
Yeah, my day-to-day is quite fluid. You know, I wouldn't say I have a set routine of what my job is. I have... You know, I'm learning. I have a lot to learn coming off the playing field. I finally have a planner here where I can fill it up and things I need to do. You know, I had that journey when I was playing, but I would write training and I'd say like eat and rest, you know, like that. And sleep. There wasn't a lot to put on there. So being organized with my time is key. I look over four different pillars of the club. So I'm in charge of the development program. The development program for us consists of our PLSQ or League One Quebec, first team in reserves. We partner with a local club here, Ottawa South United, because they have a license within the PLSQ. And I oversee that. So that's all recruitment, managing the coaches, the curriculum of what we're working on. We kind of give them, we have great coaches in place to look over those teams, but we kind of give them free rein of how they want to, you know, coach the team. They're not really emulating the first team at this moment, but we're putting in certain demands that we have here at the first team to try and implement there. Within that, we have a program called Powered by Clubs. So within the Ottawa-Gatineau region in Kingston, we have clubs that are under our branch that wear our logo, and we give them methodology, say from us or Atletico Madrid. We give them development ideas. We go out and run sessions at their club. They're part of, they had, you know, discount on ticketing, those type of things. So I
saw you had,
team
you had coaches over as well, right?
Exactly.
As part of
coaches,
that.
Mm-hmm. A coaching program. Yep. We have our Atletico Madrid camps under that. That's another pillar where we bring over our full-time academy coaches. They fly over and run the Atletico Madrid methodology here. We just had that in Gatineau on the other side of the river. And now we have it here this week in Ottawa. So I go and make sure they have everything they need. That's whether that's purchasing equipment, getting stuff out of customs, bringing over the jerseys, all those type of things that go there. And then I work with the first team as well. So I'm helping manage players, housing issues, contractual issues. I work with JD Olenowski, who's our director of soccer operations, help him. We have a great operations team, and I'm stepped away a little bit from that, but I help on the operations side as well.
It's similar to like working in a startup. You're kind of just hands-on and a little bit of everything. But I think long-term, that can benefit you massively because you really get an understanding of, okay, this is the core structure to a professional club.
Yeah, you said it right. You said it right. I think we have, when we're younger, we have an idea whether you're, let's take professional football out of it. But when you jump into a job, if you're given, which is a good thing that our CEO does, is he gives you rein to grow within your role. So, okay, you think you're going to do it this way, that may be wrong in that capacity, but let's reflect on it and say, okay, it didn't really hurt us. So let's, if you did that again, how would you do it? Right. And that's all learning for me too, is in my career is building relationships. It's becoming a good player on the field, but so much of that is what you do off the field. So it's good habits and those translate into your day to day. I don't so much enjoy sitting at my desk all the time. So that means, which I have the flexibility to work from home, or I work at a Starbucks, or I'm here in this great facility, which is nice. And I'm more effective outside my house. I don't like working at home. That's not for me. But it's good. Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I've learned a lot, right? If heaven forbid you leave the game of football, which I don't want to, but if I did, if I went to finance or whatever, I think a lot of these things would still translate right over to there.
And one of the key questions I wanted to ask is, because you've had this long-term career in terms of playing professionally, and now you've transitioned into the role where you're, especially like you mentioned, the first pillar there is development. How has that been able to help you kind of use that balance where now you're working with players that are at the stage you were at one point, and now you're sort of able to advise them and help them grow in their career? how has your experience been able to help that process?
That's a very good question. Okay. So yeah, the aspect of being a player in the development side is key to bring the validity to a player, right? They've seen you play here at TD Play, say for the local players. Hey, Drew, I remember you playing in XYZ. You went to the final, whatever, right? So to be able to show that it does have an influence, right? It does have an influence and it makes a difference. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's on them. And it goes back. I know you had spoken about you want to ask a quote later, but and I'll tell you that again. But
yeah,
you can bring a horse to water, right? You can bring a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. So you can tell, I can tell you everything you need to know, but unless you do it, take it on, implement it with your routine, how you're, you know, training day to day, how you're recovering, eating, it's not up to me, you know, it's not up to me at the end of the day. If a player's good enough, we're going to help you, right? So if they can take care of that side, then the rest will take care of itself.
Was there a key moment during your playing career where you decided, okay, look, this is sort of the route I want to take post-career and get involved in what you're working in now? Or is there a more long-term goal? Like, did you ever think of that, like, when you were during your playing time?
Very good question. Yeah, and I hope more players start, you know, doing that. I think the average career is only, you know, 3 years of playing as a professional. And if that's the case, then, you know, you need to prepare yourself for what could happen or what you want to do, what your passions are. Or you know what, you get to the end of your career and you don't know what you want to do, no problem. That's the same as well. But yes, there are little stones you can set along the way. And I remember being influenced, first in, it was an amateur semi-pro team before I went to Columbus. It was called Real Colorado Foxes. And they gave us a, you know, housing and some money and it was great. It was partly PDL type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think I was 19 at the time. And we had a team manager and I remember him running around to do everything for the guys, right? We had a team manager and an equipment manager. And those two were like stuck together like glue. And they made it a really professional environment for us. It made us feel like we were pros and getting us ready for games. And it really had a big difference. So that left an imprint on me. And then when I saw it at each club, I tried to connect with certain people within the organization to learn certain things, whether that's in the front office, to sit down with people in ticketing or the other team manager or the CEO, just to kind of get an idea of what it's like working in a pro club. What does the day-to-day work like? How do you do the financials? How do you submit contracts? And luckily, I had great people along the way. Now, that's not to say that I really wanted to be a team manager per se. That's how my role evolved. And I got to a point where I had recovered from some health stuff that was starting to have an impact on probably what my future was going to be. And so I said, is it really worth to keep pushing to play more and more years? What am I getting out of it? What's the long-term play here? Yeah, because when I retired, I still had another year on my contract to play. And I just said, look, I had my end of the year meeting with Madrid and our CEO, and they said, hey, Drew, you know, we'd love for you to stay on, but if you are interested in this position and you would like to take it, it's yours. So that was really special for them to say, okay, hey, we need this position. Would you like to do it? And I took some time to think about it, but my heart and my gut were saying it was time, and I didn't feel like chasing the game anymore. I felt like I was chasing it ever since I had some heart issues, and I just was tired of it. Not to say I lost passion for it, but I didn't really miss the games. I didn't miss the day-to-day routine. After you do it for so many years, it kind of becomes, you know, a little bit strenuous when things aren't going your way. And so I really am appreciative of a player like, you know, we have Alberto Zapater, right, who's 39. So he's been doing it for 20 plus years, 21 years. And so for me to think, oh, to play five more years, that's crazy to me. But he's also coming from a different mentality where it's in his, you know, it's in his blood as a Spaniard. That's all you're doing. He played the highest levels, right? So there's, again, everybody's story is different, and mine was just a ability to make a good transition. And so it was time to make the jump.
So you've been able to, now you've really had this career where from youth, you grew up playing in Canada, you went over to the States, now came back and played professionally here as well. What is the, how is the sort of the industry or the Canadian spectrum across the board, how has that changed over time? And where do you see the future of not only the CPL, but also you're working in with the League One system in Quebec and many different levels. So how have you seen it change sort of throughout your career? And then where do you see it from now until the future?
Yeah, so I've seen a kind of a real 360 view from when I started. There weren't many Canadians when I started in MLS. There were very few. And I think the reputation of a Canadian player was always somebody who's, you know, going to give their best, hard grit, can be dependable. But we never really had difference makers, I'd say. I'd say we have people that were always going to be 6, 7, and 8s out of 10 on a week-to-week basis. You look at like Nick Leisurewood, who was in Germany, you know, Nana Adekora, who was playing for TFC when he was young, Doniel, who was playing at TFC when he was young, Kyle Becker, these type of players that have played for so long and were dependable, top players, Carl Howarth, right, here at Ottawa, but maybe didn't get to the highest levels. Should have had some opportunities, some certain guys, but now you're seeing with the advent of our national team doing well, the women doing well, our world reputation is growing. Canada is seen as an attractive place to live. I know the cost of living is crazy, but you know, we have our own league now. That makes a huge difference, and we have people that are willing to invest in that to see succeed. You know, because it's right now it's not cash positive. It's not going to be for a little bit, right? It takes a big investment. But when you have guys that are 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, these ages, maybe not 16 and 17, but 18 to 22, and they're getting games at that age, right? Certain amount of players, it will have a compounding effect on the next 10 years. And we're already seeing the dividends right now. There are certain players that have started to grow. You know, Sirwa just got called up to the national team. And I think if you asked him 2 years ago and you see some of the, I wouldn't say mistakes, but you see the learning experiences that he had, now his confidence is at a whole new level, right? Where they just went to Miami and played against Messi and you see Sirwa there, right? He was just in CPL. And there are many examples of that. There are many examples of that. And you'd be surprised to hear some of the names that do want to come to play in Canada that have had an amazing playing career. Now, I don't think we can compete with the salaries that they want, but they're really interested in coming here. So to say where we're going to go in the next 5 to 10 years, I'm really excited. I hope the investment continues to grow. I know Atletico Madrid is fully committed to doing that here. We have ambitious goals of where we want to be, and I do see the talent in the city to cultivate that. So if I can only speak specifically on the Ottawa-Gatineau area, you're looking at hopefully we can produce another Jonathan David so one doesn't slip through, you know, our fingers. Hopefully we can identify another Alphonso Davies and cultivate him like they did at Whitecaps. Because before they go over to Europe and before they're playing for the national team, we want them to grow here within the Canadian League, right? We need more players because there's still such a small group of players that can really populate a league. If you needed 15 Canadian players per squad, let's just say that, and there's 8 teams, right? If you wanted to add 3 or 4 more teams, I don't think we have the full quality yet of players to add 45 to 60 pros. I don't think so at the CPL level that it is now. So do you want to dilute the player pool? Probably not, but you want to add more jobs. So that's a balance, right? That's a balance. How do you keep the league at a high level but bring in more jobs? So that's one thing we think about on the development side and the CPL side. And I'm really excited in seeing where we're going because for so long, us Canadians we have our own league. We're foreigners in the States. I was blessed because I had a green card, so that did help me as well. I wasn't considered a foreigner. That did help me. But Canadians are worth an international spot, and you're seeing that in Portland specifically, right? You're seeing a lot of Canadians there. So there's going to be more and more opportunities, and I hope that players can keep getting those opportunities.
And I think alongside that, you mentioned the importance of the 2006 World Cup while you were in Germany. Obviously, we're hosting now the World Cup 20 years later. What do you think that impact, I know we're talking about the Canadian football system, but what do you think that impact is going to have on the system as a whole?
Oh, it's hard to calculate, right? You have the opportunity to, I think they're having games in New York, right? They're having games in Toronto, Vancouver. I'm just thinking of the places that are close to us. I think Chicago has games. That's within distance. So you have you know, people are going to travel, right? They're going to invest to go see these games. And when you see somebody who's, you know, say, I'd say you need to be 6 or 7 years old to really understand what's going on. So let's just say seven or eight. And I see some of the players we have in our camps this week that some young, really good talent, right? So they're going to be exposed to that. Oh man, I get to see Mbappe, France versus, I don't know, France versus Colombia in New York City. It's innumerable what you can't measure it. Right. So then to say, oh, they come back with even more hunger to exceed. That helps us because they say, oh, where could I go pro? Okay. Atletico Ottawa. How do I get involved with Atletico Ottawa? Oh, I go to their camp or maybe in the future there's an academy. I want to be a part of that. Okay. So I can go through the academy and maybe I can play at 18 years old, right? Maybe I can get an exceptional talent contract. Maybe I can get a development contract. And there's so many different contracts now to see that we're trying to make it advantageous for these players to come in. And so that for them to be exposed for a World Cup in their own country, in their own in North America, and watch games on their time zone, right? You're not waking up at 6 a.m. to see a game in Australia or whatever it is, or Japan, right? I remember in the 2002 World Cup, it was in the middle of the night or, you know, those Qatar, type of things.
We had that experience Qatar. In Qatar where Canada was there, but it was still a little bit of a struggle to watch them.
Right. Yeah. I think they were on at 4 a.m. one time, right? I remember I was in Denver watching and it was on at interesting times. And I think when I went over to Germany for the first time, I was 15, 16 years old. I remember saying, oh, hey, there's a game on tonight at 8 p.m. I've never seen that before, right? I've always used to watching, I think it was back in the day when they would play the Premier League on Tuesday. So the game had happened on Saturday and then they would replay the game on Tuesday because it wasn't on TV. And I thought it was live. You know, watching Thierry Henry versus, you know, score at Highbury. And it was on Tuesday. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. It's on at 7 p.m. I didn't understand the time change, right? But you're getting – these things will cultivate more of a passion and more investment, which is key.
I want to get into some of the Insider's Lounge favorites. The first one here, you know, especially in the footballing industry, it's a roller coaster of emotion. You have these extreme highs and lows, and you're kind of going back and forth with injuries like you've spoken about. What is one big challenge that you had to face that helped you kind of push on and lead to a better career, but also in your personal life help you grow?
Oh, that's a good one. I think specifically, I played a lot of my career in the NASL, which was the league that doesn't exist anymore. Was trying to compete with the MLS back in the day. And it was the Wild West of, okay, you and I own a team, or Bob and Sue over there own a team, and we can handle it however we want. You can pay $1 billion, I can pay $100,000, and Bob and Sue can pay $15, right? They can run their teams on a budget. We're the big dogs, we want to run, and we want to get anybody who we want. Well, that's not really a sustainable model for a league, right? But for a time being, it was fun. It was fun, and it came to the end of the NASL in 2017, and there were a lot of players available, whether that was to go to the USL Championship, that was to go to MLS or go overseas. And so you had these quality players that were suddenly available. And I think that's what really started the uplift, the USL Championship, because it was a league that was below the NASL, was below the MLS in terms of quality, but it was providing sustainability. And so at that time, I had an opportunity to go play in Sweden and trial with AIK and a team called Kups in Finland. And I had signed a pre-contract with the team in Finland in the first division. They were in the Europa League, and I was real excited. I had a conversation with John Herdman when he took over, and he said, look, Drew, if you want to be involved, you got to be in Europe. And I was like, okay. I was 26 at the time. Here's my opportunity. I have a pre-contract. I'll start here. And I think I had a bad attitude in terms of looking past where I was going first. Finland was the top teams are a good league. It's a good level, very good level, and very technical level. And those top two teams are playing in Europa League, right? They're playing qualifiers. Eclipse was in the group stage. So I was like, oh, I'm getting European games right away. So I had within the contract, I had the opportunity to trial in Sweden while I had the pre-contract with Finland. So we had a week off of training. I went over there for a month. We had a week off of training because a lot of the first team players that were on the team had gone away for holidays, because in Finland specifically, they take a break in the winter because it's so cold. And so they were going to come back in the middle of December and start training again. I went to visit my buddy in Sweden, in Stockholm, and just to see him. And he, I played with him in the Jacksonville Armada team, and he's one of my great friends. So I had a week there. I wasn't feeling great. Long story short, we were training. After training, I had some pain in my back, like you've done deadlifts, right? Imagine that feeling, like you've done too much, and the next morning you're like, oh, gosh.
Yeah.
But it was a very intense pain. It was a very specific pain that I hadn't felt before. And it started to go up my back and into my arms, and my arms were going numb, and I was like, what the heck is going on? So I was having a heart attack. I was having cardiac arrest, and I didn't know it at the time, from a virus called myocarditis, which is the inflammation of the heart muscle. Luckily, my buddy was there. He took me to the hospital in Stockholm, and I was there for 2 weeks. Couldn't figure out what was going on. All these things, all different tests. Luckily, I had great care. But at the end of it, the doctor said, you can't do anything physical for 8 months. And I said, okay. That kind of kiboshes my contract, right? So I had to call the team up and say, you know what? Because I was just about to go back and sign it and join the team, and we're going to play in January. We had Europa League games in January. And you know what? That is what it is, right? That's life. And so I ended up, after 2 weeks, I flew back to the U.S. And I got into a hospital in Jacksonville. I still had my apartment in Jacksonville. And luckily, I had that there. I had taken out an insurance policy just in case something happening. So I was lucky I did that. And that covered a lot of the treatment that I needed at the hospital. But still, I found myself, I couldn't do anything physical, right? I couldn't work. I couldn't do anything like work-wise physically. So I couldn't, I really couldn't do a lot. I was just kind of a guy sitting around doing, just waiting for my body to recover. Didn't know if, at the end of 8 months, if I'd be able to play. And so I really did anything. I was a valet. I worked at a car dealership. I washed cars, easily. I tried my hand in network marketing. I got scammed into something like that. So that's funny stuff. And that was a real kick in the pants there to say, look, you got to start preparing for certain things and not put all your eggs in a basket. Luckily, I'd been a good, saver in my career. But I used those savings to pay for my treatment. So I felt at the end of 8 months, I was back at square one. You know, I'm 27 years old now. I'm back at square one. Why is this happening? All those type of things. But at the end of the day, it was a great lesson in saying, okay, things happen for a reason. You know, crap happens, for lack of a better word, and you got to get on with it. At the end of the time, I was able to recover a bit earlier, 6 months, and I was able to play again. A team gave me an opportunity, the Oklahoma City Energy, which used to be in the USL. They took me on. I'm not sure why they did, but I was very grateful to them, and I was able to come back and play and rebuild my career in a way. So that was the most trying time. But when you're going through those things, you can't pity yourself. You just got to get on with it. Because there's many, 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 many situations in the world that are way worse than that. So that was my trial in my career.
And then if someone's looking at not only your career, but maybe even your personal life and like the story you just told, and sees a path where they could follow something similar, they could follow a similar professional journey, whether it was you kind of had a unique circumstance where you went to college and then got drafted. But if someone's looking at your career now, and it can even be your work career now in terms of post career, and they seek for advice in terms of how to follow a similar path, can you give advice on that type of personality that might be interested in that pathway?
Yeah, so you don't have to be a professional player to do my job now. I think it would be pertinent to have a certain level of experience of playing or a license in terms of your footballing license, your coaching license, to be in development, right? But one, you got to have the passion for it. Do you really, really love the game, right? You're not going to make millions in this job, not here in North America at least. So do you really love what you're doing? How are you creating relationships with others, right? How are you finding unique ways to connect with others? I think that's the biggest thing, right? Is just putting yourself out there, having the courage to talk to somebody. I know we hired two different people specifically for my team because they they sent me a LinkedIn message and just, you know, saying, hey, you know, if you ever think you need somebody or a coach to be at camp, I'd love to be there. Right. And there's always a, there's always something that happens where you come back and say, oh, I actually needed somebody. And I remember that guy reached out, and that's how it happens. Right. If you're putting yourself out there, it's, you know, someone's going to notice you, and we need good people. And once you give somebody an opportunity, they're going to succeed with it or they're going to flop. Most of the time, they're going to succeed. I'd say 99% of the time, they're going to succeed, especially at this level, right? You're not where the millions of dollars are not on the line. Yeah, there's money on the line for sure. But when we put them in situations where they're going to succeed, right, too, it's important that we don't put them right to the knife at the beginning, mm-hmm. right? So yeah. we give them opportunities to grow. But it all starts out with them, you know, reaching out to me and say, hey, I really love the team. I've been a supporter, XYZ. I love the opportunity to be a part of it. And we're growing too. You know, it's, there's not always, it just works with perfect timing, the team growing at the same time, things happen. So if that's my recommendation, is just put yourself out there and be there, show up, right? Show up and you're going to be there. You're going to do it.
And then we've spoken through all the sort of different phases of your career so far. And I'm sure if you went back to your 20-year-old self and you said in 10 years, I'm going to be X, Y, and Z, you'd be completely confused on sort of the journey that you've taken in that time. But now if we sit down and we had this same conversation in let's say 10 years time, where do you think you'll be or where do you want to be? And how do you see your personal life playing through and your career wise?
Another good question. In 10 years, where do I see myself? I'd love to still be in football. I'd love to be a sporting director or a CEO of a club. I love what Fernando does here. He's done a great job. Looking back, he basically started this club by himself, right? We didn't have really anybody in the front office. He came over from Spain. He mastered the English language, right? It's just second language. And he started a club. Madrid said, here, take this money, go start a club. And he did it during a pandemic and by himself, basically. Bootstrapped it by himself. So to learn all he does now on the other side, I'd really love to do that if I'm going to stay in football. I'm also getting my licenses to coach. We'll see if I'm going to coach. I don't know. Maybe. So in 10 years, maybe I'd love to be in MLS somewhere helping a team. Yeah, whether that's in the front office, not coaching wise. I love connecting with players on that side and helping them acclimatize to a club, whatever they need to get set up, you know, their family set, right? When their families are happy, they're going to play better. That's known throughout the game. Those type of things are important to me. Connecting with, I have friends around the world, right? That I get to connect with on a day-to-day basis that I wouldn't have without football. Speaking Spanish has been great to being able to connect with certain players. But it's an exciting life too. You never know what's going to happen today. Yep. Yesterday we had an immigration issue with a guy we had to sort out. We had to call the lawyers. And so it makes it exciting. I don't think my missus enjoys that I'm on the phone all the time, but she has to know that's just part of the job.
Totally. All right. We'll finish off with some quick fire questions here. What's your childhood club? Who did you support?
Manchester United.
All right, I thought it was going to be Arsenal there because you were speaking of Henry earlier.
No, I just remember watching Henry kill Man United, so that was growing up. That's what I remember.
There you go. And you mentioned your favorite quote, so if you want to repeat it or if you have another one, feel free and give us some background on it.
You can't bring a horse. You can bring a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. So, right, you can show people the path, you can show people the routine, you can show them how to be professional, but at the end of the day, they need to take it upon themselves to execute.
And if someone's taking a trip to Ottawa, what are the top recommendations, food spots that you got to hit up or potentially a game?
I wouldn't say we're known too much for our food, unfortunately, but there's a great place. We have, there's a place on Preston Street, which is near TD Place. There's a place called Mati. I recommend that. It's a top, top place. But seeing Parliament is a must see, right? Downtown is great. The National Gallery is also amazing. We have great architecture here. We have a very European vibe city with our French and English. You got to go to Gatineau Park as well on the Gatineau side.
And do you have a favorite book? Are you a big reader?
Yes. I love Open by Andre Agassi. I don't know if you've read that one. It's the most, as its name states, the most open I've ever heard an athlete be. I don't know if you've read that one, but I recommend it for anybody, even if you're not in sport. Just the honesty and to know that somebody did something at the highest level that they didn't enjoy doing, which is crazy to me.
Yeah, it's crazy. No, I haven't read that one, so I'll have to add it
highly
to the list.
Recommend
Do you have some favorite hobbies just on the side where you, if you need a break from football and you just want to take a different route for that night or the day, what's a go-to hobby?
I got one of those gaming computers. I'm not good at gaming.
I saw that with the headphones last time, actually.
Yeah, I never have been, and I never, but to relax, it seems counterintuitive, but there's the game, the Fall Guys game where you run with your little character. I like that. I do that with some of my friends. And the Warzone. I like playing Warzone. I get killed all the time, but it's a way for me to disconnect. And when there's a lot of things going on, I can talk with my friends. Most of the time, we just end up talking about life and playing some silly game. So that's some fun hobbies for me. I love working on cars, too. I usually buy project cars and have them for 6 to 8 months and use them, and then I sell them and I get something new. I never will buy another new car. I will just never do it. I always get a used car.
And if you could sit down with one person for dinner, dead or alive, they can be from sort of any generation, who's it going to be? I've hit a cap of three, so I'll give you three people if you want to sort of mix and match.
Oh gosh, I remember seeing this question. I didn't think about it.
So most people do like a footballing personality and then one or two just from
general. Let's do that. Let's do that. I would love to sit down with Sir Alex Ferguson, have dinner with Sir
He's
Alex
the most
Ferguson.
Most popular, so it's funny you said
right,
that.
Right, I was going to say the most popular. Oh, man. I'd like to sit down with David Goggins. I'd like to hear more about him. I know I've read the book, but just to see the intensity at which that guy just operates, that would be really cool. And last one. Oh gosh. If we're going to say a soccer player, I'd probably sit down with Raul. I play against him as a player. I've got to know him as a coach. He's a legend of the biggest club in the world. I've had some conversation with him, but I'd like to pick his brain on a few things. So yeah, those three would be right off the top of my head. I should know this better, but those are three.
No, that's a good mix. I couldn't imagine seeing them all three at a dinner table at once, but hey, you never know.
Yeah, that'd be good.
No, this was great, Drew. I really appreciate your time. If you have any last words, wrap things up, and then we'll head out.
No, I really appreciate it. You know, people like yourself who are, you know, exposing this side of the game to the public is important, and I appreciate you having me on and doing this.
No, that's great. I really appreciate your time, and I look forward to speaking again soon.
Awesome. Thanks, brother.